ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every week now, there's another story that reveals the potential of AI.
From faster breakthroughs to bigger companies to more devastating warfare.
But do we actually understand what we're building here?
What if we're thinking about it in a way that doesn't compute?
I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Waleed Ali. On this episode of Global Roaming, we separate the hype from the hard truths about AI.
Hi, Waleed. Lovely to have your company today. We haven't done this before, a joint episode of Global Roaming.
Yes, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you very much for having me. I was going to say excited. I'm terrified about AI. I'll be frank about that. There's what it means, what it does, what it can do, what it is and what it isn't, and all the arguments about that. But then there's just the international and geopolitical overlay of this is extraordinary. Principally the US and China, of course, but Australia being swept up in this. How are your nerves, Kylie?
Look, I'm not a panicker, but I am unsettled, I think would be the best way of describing it. I use it on a very basic level. My kids already use it way better than I do, and I'm starting to understand the potential of that. But I understand too that I am talking about a squillionth of what the potential of this is, and certainly in terms of, as you describe it, the geopolitical fallout, how it changes the way that alliances work, it changes what our priorities are, it resets everything, it resets the economy. All of that is a lot to keep in your head at the same time. It is, after all, a kind of new fault line in geopolitics and national power.
And we'll get to that stuff as well. We're going to need some help with a guest. It's wonderful. We do have a guest that will do that. So we'll get to the geopolitical stuff. But what do you say we begin with figuring out what we're actually talking
about? Well, we are talking about systemic change. We are talking about a stock market surge, you know, that's thrilling Wall Street, even as the rest of us just panic about fuel shortages and tricky alliances. I mean, I feel like it's a category shift, isn't it, to try and get your head around where AI is operating above and beyond us. And I would hope that when we talk to our guest today, we're going to be able to cut through some of that to better understand the contours below.
I think that's an excellent idea, Kylie. Let's get stuck in. Our guest today is Rohit Krishnan, who's an AI investor and operator, so he has very practical knowledge of this, but he's also a thinker on it. He's a Substack essayist. His Substack is called The Strange Loop. Canon.
Here's that conversation now. Rohit Krishnan, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
A distinction that I keep hearing in the language is this idea of generative AI, or perhaps even more relevantly, agentic AI. And this strikes me as a fundamentally different form of technology, if it's true to speak about it in those terms, not as a tool, but actually as an agent, as something that can be to some extent, perhaps an unknowable extent, self-directing, that can code itself. We're seeing it now being taught to code itself, and then it might go off in all sorts of directions. In other words, that something that has some kind of digital version of a will that it can impose on the world or on itself or on others. I suppose this is where I need you to come in and set us straight. Are we talking about a real difference there? Is this a really existing or potentially existing thing? Or is this the sort of the conjurings of our most dystopian imagination?
So there are two aspects to it. So first of all, it's real, right? I mean, there should be absolutely no confusion about the fact that what we have today can do things that seem miraculous, even to people who are building it or who are using it daily on a regular basis. I think that is just fact. However, a curious problem that we have is that we lack the vocabulary to describe the things that it is doing without invoking things like will or consciousness or sapience or intentionality or agentic behavior, all of which are terms that apply to humans or we apply to each other, we apply to animals, and they mean something to us because they come embedded with like billions of years of, you know, evolution that we've all gone through. And sort of we can kind of understand when I say like that horse behaves as if it's going to do something, we are ascribing an intentionality to that animal that we can then do something about. We are ascribing a similar intentionality right now to these agents or these kind of this AI. However, it obviously doesn't have it, right? Because if you're not going to ask a question, the agents are not going to come back and ask you for anything because they do not have an internal persistent life that they're coming with. Now, coming to your first part of the question, what is the difference? The generative part of generative AI primarily should be contrasted with the previous many generations of AI, which are not generative in the sense that they're transformative. Even this current crop of AI can be. What that means is like, let's take a translation example. Like suppose I was speaking in, you know, Mandarin and you wanted to hear the answer in French. The content of what I'm saying does not change. You just need to transform it from one language to the other. That is fundamentally different to if I was trying to tell you a story where every new thing that I say is additive to the things that came before. You're not just transforming some input. You have some core basic input and you're just rolling stuff out, right? You're getting things that you did not put into it in the first place. That is what is new about this technology. And when they first started discovering it, if you go back and look at like whatever GPT-1, 2, they were kind of babbles quite a lot. Occasionally you would get a sentence and that would be like the greatest thing in the world. But what's happened is that over a period of time, as we have scaled data, as we have scaled compute, we are now able to kind of feed it enough information, including how we want certain things answered. And as a result, Waleed, like you said, you can now have it write its own code. You can give it a vague instruction like I have going on in a window over there to kind of go do a series of analyses that I kind of wanted that I just kind of, you know, jotted down. And it goes off and does most of them. Some of it is because we have taught specifically what each one of them means or generally what this class of problems mean. Some of it is just because we are now able to truly generate models which can, again, anthropomorphic term, but like think for themselves and kind of do what you ask them to, not just transform it from one input to another output without really adding any of its own nous to it.
Anthropic's decision, right, not to release its latest model, so the Mythos model publicly, has kind of fueled fears that this model is too powerful for wider use. Now, I take your point that we don't really have the right language to talk about this and we're anthropomorphizing some of these systems. But in reality, what did that Anthropic experience tell us?
So this one is actually, funnily enough, easier to talk about because Mythos very clearly sits on the same curve of capabilities increasing over time as the sort of models came before. It is the next sort of big leap, shall we say, because we have like minor increases, you know, 4.6, 4.7, 4.8 or whatever, 5.4, 5.5. And we have some leaps and Mythos very clearly stays within that. From Anthropic's perspective, OpenAI has the same thing. You know, they talk about the stuff of like, they want to be responsible in how they release these models. Because one way to think about these models is that they're bundles of capabilities that anybody can use. So if, you know, I am not a great programmer, but if I have the models to help me out, I can actually accomplish what an incredibly good programmer could have accomplished in a week, like 10 years ago, probably in an afternoon now. So it compresses the skill sets quite a lot, or it enhances your skill sets. Now, Mythos in particular, they measure these against, you know, the ability for it to give you novel biological information, novel cybersecurity information, etc. The specific part of Mythos's capabilities that Anthropic said gave them pause was that it was really good at cybersecurity analysis, including finding zero-day attacks that are possible to do against a series of software. There's a lot of controversy about how true this statement is in the sense that everybody who works in software knows that there are tons of zero days. Not all of them are exploitable at all. But, you know, if you're a really good security researcher, you can actually find some of them.
Can I just stop you for a minute?
Please.
Can you tell us what a zero day is?
Oh, apologies. A zero day is a security vulnerability that exists in a software that has not been published yet that you do not know about. So it's basically new. Like nobody knows that there's a hole like this that exists. And it might be small, it might be large, it might be in a corner. But as you can imagine, from a hacking perspective, finding a zero-day vulnerability is sort of super important. Because if there are vulnerabilities people know about and you know different ways of patching it, et cetera, maybe you don't go all the way towards patching the software immediately because that's hard to do, but you can find ways to kind of work around it. But if you find a vulnerability zero-day, that is really critical, right, for the software, because you can theoretically find and exploit people who are using it.
You're listening to Global Roaming with me, Kylie Morris, and Waleed Ali, and we are speaking to Rohit Krishnan about the wonders and perils of AI. So imagine you're using Mythos, and I have a system that I think is pretty watertight, and your Mythos model finds problems, finds these zero-day attacks, or is able to locate where the zero-day attacks could be successfully launched. Then I presumably have to come up with my own model, which is pretty good at defending against something like Mythos, to make sure that you can't do that. And do we risk then getting into a kind of arms race in cybersecurity where each new model is trying to outstrip the capabilities of the other, to the point where you're frozen by the risks of what might come next?
The answer is yes. Cybersecurity has always been an arms race. In a previous life, I used to invest in cybersecurity. And one of the things I used to say why I liked it was because it is the only white collar profession where you get to feel like James Bond occasionally, or at least talk like him. Because everything is adversarial, right? Cybersecurity should not exist unless there is adversarial nature inherent in it. People keep trying to find new ways to attack, other people trying to find new ways to defend, and the industry kind of keeps going. So to answer to your question is like, absolutely. If Mythos gives you the capability to identify new vulnerabilities such that you need to go attack them, you need something that can identify those vulnerabilities for you faster such that you can defend against them. I think that is kind of the normal way of doing it. Now, part of the argument that goes against this speculation is that vulnerabilities kind of exist, but they're not infinite, right? Like there is a tailing off curve. There is an S curve somewhere where you find the major ones and you keep finding minor ones, but it's not like the next 10% of vulnerabilities is equally as bad as the previous 10% you patched always. Sometimes it can be, but not always. So the question in some sense for Mythos in particular is like, once models are really good at coding, which is kind of what its underlying, you know, ethos is, underlying all of these models, they're trying to get better and better at coding. Once these models are really good at coding, what capabilities do they democratize to everybody who uses them such that it can create unintended consequences around the world? And a sudden deployment of a model that can sufficiently identify massive vulnerabilities is one of them, according to Anthropic. There is an argument that people have made that like many of the vulnerabilities that it identified are, some are big, not all of them are. And at the same time, Anthropic themselves are under a crazy compute crunch. Like they literally do not have enough GPUs to be able to serve these models to everybody. So from their perspective, they have to find a way to like compress that and just provide it only to select like the US government and a few sort of companies to say, we are willing to provide it to you just under sort of lock and key, as it were, but rather than giving it out to me, Kale, like you were saying, I'd love to have access to it, but I don't.
But can they trust the US government? I suppose that's the thing. If you have this all powerful
question,
no, but that must be a question for Anthropic, right? If they're trying to set up guardrails and kind of safety and security provisions around this all powerful tool, and they're saying it's so dangerous, we're only going to let a select group of companies and institutions get access to it. Aren't they then depending upon those clients not misusing or abusing it?
They absolutely are. I think, you know, this is one of those cases where recently we had the row between Anthropic and the Department of Defense, you know, about precisely this issue, that the question of who should decide what is allowed versus not allowed is not an easy question, because every software, every product has some terms of service or terms of use that they say, this is roughly how we think it should be used. Most products, you cannot tell the buyer how they should use it in any meaningful sense. Now, once it goes to a cloud software, they can do a little bit more, but still, like if I'm using Salesforce and I am part of, I don't know, Pablo Escobar's new cartel, there's very little that Salesforce can do beyond noticing that, oh, we have a customer in Colombia, something iffy is going on, and just cut them off. But that, fixing on one particular customer, going into their data and solving it is a really hard problem for most pieces of software to solve for. When it comes to intelligence that is provided over the cloud, this becomes even more important. Because should Anthropic be in charge of telling the US government what they can and cannot do with the model versus how much should the US government be able to use the model for whatever purposes they as well as Congress has authorized is a really iffy question. It's one of the biggest debates going on at the moment in Washington. I mean, I have my own point of view. I'm sure everybody does. But ultimately, this is one where I don't think there are clean answers either. Because clearly, handing it over and saying, do what you want is not always straightforward or easy. We've had the, you know, Snowden leaks and NSA issues, et cetera, before. At the same time, a private company trying to decide how the government should use its technology and like handcuffing them by requiring guarantees is also not okay, because that is a really cumbersome way for the government to do business in the first place.
Yeah, I think where that particular story got particularly iffy was the US government then saying, okay, well, we'll designate you a supply risk. And so we'll just ban you from the government from trading with you. And then that would ultimately be devastating for Anthropic. At least that was the theory, unless maybe they drum up business elsewhere like China or something. But that's where I think, you know, you saw the White House or the Department of War, I suppose it was, overstep what would seem to be the bounds of the argument you've sketched, and which I think is a fairly reasonable argument. We should acknowledge, I think, that this whole conversation that we're having, there are social, there are economic, there are employment dimensions to this, there are artistic dimensions, there are human dimensions that are huge, really important, potentially devastating. But there is also a geopolitical overlay that we simply cannot ignore. And that is the arms race, if we're using that terminology, between what China's doing with AI and then what's happening in the US. And we've just seen China now put out DeepSeek 4. In the context of this arms race, there's this sort of geopolitical context. Can you tell us what that means? What is the significance of what's just been released out of China?
So China has no shortage of talent. It has no shortage of energy. It has a massive shortage of chips. What this effectively means is that for better or for worse, I think for worse, US and China are becoming more and more adversarial over this idea of designating each other or looking at each other as enemies and making sure that you cannot get that first because I want to get it first. Once something starts being seen as an arms race, then very clearly you start seeing battle lines being drawn. China has its own domestic chip industry led by Huawei. They have Ascent chips. They're just not as good as NVIDIA chips. So if you look at DeepSeek V4, DeepSeek are an incredibly smart team led by the best researchers, I think probably globally. They are really, really, really smart. However, they simply do not have sufficient resources in terms of chips to be able to train the kind of models that we are easily able to train in the US. Because, you know, for better or for worse, to put it in another terms, DeepSeek just said like they're going to go to a fundraise and they were going to be valuing themselves at like $10 billion or something. Thinking Machines, which is a Mira Murati's startup, which has yet to release a product, was also valued at $10 billion. The US capital markets are an insane competitive advantage. Put these two things together, what China needs are more chips such that they can train cutting edge models if they want to retain supremacy in trying to create better and better frontier models. I think that is the single most important conceptual like battle line that needs to be drawn here. We don't really know where that is going to play out. I mean, let's take a scenario. If Huawei makes a breakthrough and are able to make the kinds of chips that NVIDIA are making, then China will leapfrog ahead simply because they have way more energy and they have no shortage of talent. Whereas US, I mean, you might have seen the news, like, you know, there is such a huge public outcry for good and terrible reasons against building them in many different places in the country. And there's a general feeling and anti-tech sentiment that is kind of sweeping part of the nation as well. Those are some of the ethos that feeds into the battle lines that are getting drawn domestically between the two countries. But make no mistake that like DeepSeek is a wonderful new model, even if it's not clearly superior in all benchmarks.
You know who does make chips? Taiwan. I mean, do you want me to join dots or do you just want to respond to that fact?
I think everybody since, including during the election of the current administration here and before, during Biden's era, during the previous Trump, there's a reason Taiwan is increasing in geopolitical importance. This is the main reason. They try to get TSMC to come and build fabs in Arizona, which supposedly have started producing. I haven't looked at the latest, but this is not an easy thing to solve. Because let's assume, I mean, even geopolitically, if Taiwan gets taken over, that's insufficient because ASML, the only people who can build the EUV machines in order to help create the chips are based in Netherlands. Like, we live, for better or worse, in an incredibly connected modern economy. Like, the battle lines, despite how clearly you might want to draw them and become more protectionist, are not as easy to control. But the Taiwan, there's a reason it is the single, it is the number one most important issue as it comes to this particular point of view, because we need the chips.
Rohit, do we know what we don't know on a political level? I ask that because I was involved in coverage of the Cambridge Analytica scandal a few years ago and saw, the boss of Meta turn up in Congress to appear before a committee. And the senators were literally asking him how their phones worked. And could they explain to him how it is that they could more easily access Facebook on their phones? And Mark Zuckerberg is sitting there with 25 lawyers thinking, really, is this the best you've got? And I do wonder about our capabilities at a political level, not only in the US, but certainly in places like Australia. Do we even understand what the parameters are of what we need to think about and legislate for?
I am highly skeptical. I believe it at that. I don't even feel like I remember part of that. I think that's the interview where Zuckerberg famously said, "Senator, we sell ads," which was one of the best quotes I have heard come from Congress. However, I feel like, you know, if we were one of the interesting things about this current phase of AI, this has moved incredibly fast, right? ChatGPT was released like 3.5 years ago. GPT-3 was released maybe 4.5. Like, if we were having this conversation 5-6 years ago, which is not much in the political sense, but it is incredibly fast in the AI world, even if it is not as fast in the technology world, the changes have been massive. So even if you're a senator who's very well informed about AI and you're making your decisions on the basis of the capabilities that existed a year ago or a year and a half ago, you would be hopelessly out of date because you would not know the capabilities of the modern agentic systems like Codex or Claude Codec can actually perform. You might still be thinking of these as, oh, these are the models that could not write a decent briefing for me, whereas now they can solve ERDOS problems. So the speed with which we are increasing capabilities is not something that the political system really has the ability to handle.
Rohit, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you and get your expertise. As someone who knows the technology but is also investing and so has to, you know, put their money where their mouth is on a lot of this stuff, thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thanks, guys. This was lovely.
Well, it's a wonderful world out there, Waleed. And I've got to say, at times I had to kind of really scrunch to keep up with what Rohit was saying. But wow, I mean, you know, where is the end of learning? It's real. This is happening. Look at Taiwan, look at China. You do now feel an all-pervasive sense, right, that this is not only is it coming, but we're in it and it's all around us now.
Yes, and I have to say the thing that worries me about this is ultimately control, or perhaps a better word is mastery. And I hear what Rohit's saying. That did you notice that a lot of what he was saying was couched in, well, at the moment? And so there's the question of where the frontiers of this are and exactly how far it goes. I was hoping to be calmed down by Rohit. I can't say I am entirely. I mean, there's this saying, Kylie, you must have heard it before. You've heard a version of it, which is that the battle between locksmiths and safecrackers is never ending. And when you cast that into the AI realm, and then you think about how much of critical infrastructure is going to be reliant on AI, and then you cast that into the geopolitical realm, where the most devastating way to wage war, it would seem to me, would be not to bother sending armies or anything, but just to shut down some AI dependent piece of infrastructure or something like that. And you go back to the safe crackers and the locksmiths, and you factor in that it just takes one fault to be found, but you, to defend it, you have to defend every single one of them. I just don't know that I like the maths of it, Kylie, is what I'm saying. And the potential disproportion between cause and effect. We've never seen this before as a species. That's what I keep thinking. I can't get around it. Can you help me with that?
No. But I can express solidarity, if you like. For me, I was intrigued by his idea that we don't even have the language to talk about what we need to be talking about. So I feel like our democratic systems, this is what I'm, I guess, most fearful of, is how our democratic systems manage this. Can they? Are we robust enough? And if we're not in that sense, then it is the tech lords in the end and their imaginings and also AI's imaginings that define where the end of learning is, right? Where this stops. And maybe I'm thinking in a really analog way because, of course, it's not going to stop.
No, it won't.
It's just a question of where can we even control the ways in which it flows into our lives and societies, our warfare, our economies.
I think your point, though, about the capacity, the capability, literally the ability of politicians to regulate this, given how little they often know. And by the way, it's not reasonable to expect them to know at this level of technology. I think it's a really important point, a really important question. The thing about it, though, Kylie, is there's a question that comes before that, which is, do they even want to? So coming out of the United States, I mean, the Trump administration has taken a very clear position on basically not getting in AI's way. And it's banned states. So the big, beautiful bill that Donald Trump had was...
That's right. It removed the powers of the states to control.
Which leaves it to a Congress that hasn't shown the capacity to do very much. And at the moment, an administration that actively doesn't want to intervene. In Australia, you've had the Productivity Commission say, don't come up with special regulations for AI. And Ed Husic, who as minister had carriage of this for a while, does think we should regulate AI specifically, but his colleagues who are in government don't. So there's not even the political will before you get to the question of capacity. And then I suppose it becomes, well, if you don't do it now, at some point a horse bolts, doesn't it? At that point, I'm not sure what happens. So it feels to me, and maybe you're different, maybe listeners are different, I don't know, but that we are embracing a level of unknown here with potential consequences that stretch into the military realm that I don't recall us really ever doing before. I don't know if you can think of another example beyond maybe the wheel or something.
I think that's the thing. The shift that we're observing maybe isn't that AI is changing the world, but it's changing how the world changes, how quickly it can be transformed, and who controls that transformation. I don't want to scare anyone with this conversation, Waleed, but I think it's really important on a program like Global Roaming. We're not a tech program. We don't normally focus very closely on this issue, but it is certainly going to have a massive influence on the way nations deal with one another, on warfare, on the international economy. So it's definitely worth us grappling with. I would say we'd love to hear from you. Don't forget to write to us. We love your questions and your feedback as ever. So please keep it coming. Our email address is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Huge thanks to you, Kylie, for having me.
It's been
today.
A pleasure.
You didn't have to do that. I appreciate it. Thanks for letting me squat all over your program. And a big thanks to our producer for today, Aston Brown. Latika and Geraldine will be on the show tomorrow. See you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.